This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashrin Johan. And recently, the government launched D-Date TV, which is an educational channel for students in primary and secondary school to keep up with the syllabuses amid the COVID-19 pandemic. So now this in concept is great, right? However, there was a video that went viral recently in which a science teacher was mocked for her English proficiency. Here's the thing. I think people were too busy complaining about a science teacher's English standard that many missed the bigger issue. The teacher, while conducting her class on the human reproductive system, started by saying, "A male and a female adult will need to get married before having a child." Now, is that statement problematic? So joining me on the show today to discuss the clip as well as sex education in Malaysia is Sivanandi Tanindaran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Centre for Women, also known as AROW. Welcome to the show, Siva. How are you doing?
I'm feeling great. Thank you, Darshan. Great to be here with you again.
Siva, did you watch the clip of this video that I just brought up in the introduction?
I watched a small portion of it, and of course, Twitter made me very aware of this video and the contents of the video.
And what were your initial thoughts when you came across it?
Well, I thought that, you know, the public was really a little bit harsh on the teacher and the standard of English. But I noted that you also had tweeted about pregnancy, her statement that pregnancy is what happens after two people get married. And I'm glad that you brought that up. Because I think that that's the crux of a little bit of the skew on what human reproduction is all about, which is conveyed to the students. I think that firstly, it shows that, you know, that abstinence-only sex education is something that has been generally part of the Malaysian school curriculum, right? And this kind of restricts access of young people to accurate information. So always the social frame that is provided is that sex occurs within a heterosexual marriage, and it only occurs within that context alone. And when these statements are like kind of made, then, you know, it creates a lot of misinformation. And a lot of young people may not actually know, you know, how does a pregnancy occur? Right. Mm-hmm. So the reality is, of course, very different because the Global School-Based Health Student Health Survey, which was carried out by the Ministry of Health in 2012, which involved students from Form 1 to Form 5, indicated that 50.4% of students, that's more than half of the students, had sexual intercourse for the first time before the age of 14 years. Clearly, most of them are not married, right? Yep. So sex is not actually something that is happening with a man and woman within the state of marriage. And then so this data, you know, reveals to us that early exposure to sex without protection against unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections amongst young people is a reality, right? Mm-hmm. So despite the early sexual encounters amongst teens, the disturbing part is the lack of sexual and reproductive health knowledge among them. And then there was a survey, you know, there's a nationwide survey of 1,071 Malaysian youths from public and private universities, which revealed that 35% of the respondents did not believe that a woman can get pregnant during the first sexual engagement. And this is not only in Malaysia. Across the world, where we do work with comprehensive sexuality educations and young people, sexual and reproductive health and rights, many of them have this myth that, oh, you know, if you do it only one time, you don't actually, you can't make a baby. So in Indonesia, I remember a study, you know, where the respondent had said that, you know, the line that is used by boys with girls is that, you know, if you do it one time, you only make the years.
I think that's so, just what guys are, you know, trying to trick themselves or trick the girls.
Yeah. So it's like, so there's a lot of misinformation out there. And that's why giving the right information is absolutely essential, right? So, and so definitely there is a dire need for the implementation of comprehensive sexuality education, both in and out of school adolescents, in order to provide accurate, complete, and consistent information on sexual and reproductive health and rights.
Okay, now going back to the clip, right? What is the potential impact of teaching kids this in science class? You see, on the one hand, it can be interpreted as abstinence-only education, which is something we want, I want to touch on a little bit later. But on the other hand, it can also be seen as the teacher saying that pregnancy can only happen if you're married, which is, of course, not scientifically accurate at all. I mean, I'm not married, so does that mean I can have unprotected sex with a woman and she's not going to get pregnant?
Exactly. And so that's why I think, you know, that same survey, you know, which talked about, like, if you have the first sex encounter, that you can get pregnant. Some did not even know that they can get pregnant from sex, because maybe, you know, they think that they get pregnant from marriage. And I think because sex education is so wrapped up in so much of taboo, right? Mm-hmm. So teachers feel uncomfortable talking about all aspects of it, or they want to get through that lesson as fast as possible, or that chapter as fast as possible. And I think that, you know, throughout our lifetimes and different conversations that we've had, you know, that's the part that, you know, teachers will tell students, okay, that section, you know, draw this drawing of the male and female reproductive system, and then, you know, read it for yourself, and you know that that chapter is over in, like, you know, 20 minutes instead of the regular 45 minutes.
Do you think that this could contribute to social problems such as teen pregnancies? You know, like this very vague, very, you know, maybe culturally wrapped version of sex education that they're teaching in science classes or reproductive chapters and stuff. Do you think these are some of the contributing factors to problems such as teen pregnancies?
Yeah, definitely, you know, because, you know, behind almost, I mean, like, we see the media sensationalizing, you know, cases of baby dumping, right? Mm-hmm. But behind almost every case of baby dumping is an unplanned pregnancy, right? And that unplanned pregnancy is a result of unsafe and unprotected sex, which is in turn caused by this lack of sexual education and knowledge. So the Malaysian Population and Family Survey, the fifth one, reported that among adolescents who had sex, and adolescents is from 10 to 19 now, okay, so only 35.1% used contraceptives. That is, nearly 2 out of 3 were not using contraceptives.
That is so, right? Scary.
Exactly. So this is so, and hence we can see a rising number of adolescent pregnancies in the country. In fact, that one data that was shared with us, I think about a couple of years back, is that annually there are 18,000 teenagers who get pregnant in this country, right? So there's also a strong stigma attached to unwed mothers, which results in these young single mothers abandoning their babies due to fear and shame, right? Because pregnant teens are afraid to seek help from the appropriate channels because there's social prejudice, but also law that penalizes consensual sex by anyone under 18 years of age.
Mm. But Siva, some might argue, right, that the syllabus that's currently being taught in schools, that the syllabus is actually fine as is, and that we shouldn't be teaching kids about the realities of sex and reproduction. And it's good to tell kids, you know, especially primary school kids, that pregnancies happen only after marriage. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, access to right information is absolutely critical. And the thing about sex education is people think that, okay, if we teach sex education, you know, kids will suddenly, like, you know, tomorrow go and have sex. But I think that we are taught in school to, like, you know, make little machines and everything in physics, and nobody does it. I mean, like, you're taught, right? You're taught to, like, do pulley systems and right, all of that, but we've not turned out to be MacGyver. But I think that what sex education does is, should you then decide, make a decision to have sex, then you will do it correctly, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to take the perspective that, you know, sex education, you know, equips children and young people the necessary knowledge and skills, you know, which will empower them to realize their health and their well-being, you know. And it's not only about having sex. I mean, that's one aspect of it. But also there's a part of comprehensive sexuality education that deals with respecting boundaries, you know, and understanding consent. And you can see in the media, you know, all of these instances that have come forth, whether it's unwanted comments or unwanted touches or, you know, wrong negotiation of relationships or misunderstanding signals that, you know, people give, right? Mm-hmm. So all of this is coming to the fore. And, you know, so one of the things that comprehensive sexuality education teaches is, you know, how do you ask for consent? What is that consent mean? Why is it important to have that consent, right? So I think that that also is imparted through comprehensive sexuality education. And some of it is like, you know, so it also reduces, you know, forced sexual violence on others.
Right.
So there's a whole like dimension of thinking that comes into play when we impart comprehensive sexuality education to young people.
And how young do you think kids should be when they start learning about learning comprehensive sexuality education, you know, learning about their bodies, learning about sex?
Mm. So maybe I can like put the question back to you. So right. Dashrin, mm-hmm. how old were you when you first learned about sex education?
Whew. Okay, you're putting me on the spot here. I think I started to feel things that I didn't quite understand, even as early as 6 years old, perhaps. But I only started to learn about sex, I think, in primary 5 or primary 6. And unfortunately, just like most people, I learned it from equally uninformed and unknowledgeable friends, right? And in early secondary school, I think my dad did try to have some of these conversations with me a little bit. But it wasn't like we had these conversations casually and consistently. It was more like a couple of awkward sessions with, you know, code words being used and things like that. Later on in life, I just started doing my own research by reading about it a lot. And I think that has been the biggest help to me.
Right. So, you see, so I think that you're absolutely right. Most people, like, we kind of discover it on our own, right?
Right.
At a certain time because, you know, our peers are talking about it. And then now kids explore the internet, right?
Yes.
And there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet. And usually what young people, like, get is, like, the not right information on the internet, right? Basically, people are obtaining their concepts around sex and relationships from porn. So, which is not a right thing at all. This is why when we talk about comprehensive sexuality education, if we look at the International Technical Guidance on Comprehensive Sexuality Education, which is presented by UNESCO, we often talk about age-appropriate, you mm-hmm. know, comprehensive sexuality education, and it should start as young as 5. Now, people say, like, oh, why do you need to study this at 5? I mean, like, you know, you don't study calculus at 5. But because society is formed in such a way, from the age of 4 or 5, children should already need to be taught things like what is good touch, what is bad touch, right?
Right?
So, like, you know, just like you, I mean, like, my first experience of learning from comprehensive sexuality education was, you know, through a book. My mom brought home a book. It was called Where Did I Come From? Written by Peter Mayle. It had books, it had illustrations. And it was like it was really a great book. Interestingly enough, that time this book could be borrowed by the library in Malaysia. But if I'm not mistaken, this book is currently banned because of its pictures, right?
Wow.
So that also has shown the shift of society and how we are framing, you know, some of these conversations. So I feel like, you know, we have to like kind of say, okay, at 5 years old, they need to know these kind of concepts. At 8, you know, a particular sort of concept. At 12, you know, a different sort of concept. You know, at 18, you know, a different sort of concept, right? So they are, it's kind of age appropriate, and it builds upon the ability to understand and explore as well as the challenges that you may face.
And I think that's a very, very interesting point, right? Because in Malaysia, we often talk about how, you know, kids shouldn't learn comprehensive sexuality education. They're too young, yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, it's also an undeniable fact that kids are learning all the wrong things anyway. You know, like when I was 13 and in school, it was just crazy. Like people on their phones, like all of us were curious. The person who had porn on their mobile phones was like the coolest kid that everyone wanted to surround him and watch what's on his phone. And this is just the reality. So even if we don't And the fact that you don't want to teach the proper thing doesn't mean that kids are not exposed to it anyway.
No, absolutely, so there is a number of things that are there, right? I mean, because you learn gender roles in a relationship, and I've never seen a piece of porn that actually conveys to me the type of relationship that I would aspire to have.
Oh, definitely.
And then it also talks a lot about dominant and submissive relationships, in which mostly, the males are dominant and the females are submissive, and I think that there's a whole variety of things that are happening there that don't actually kind of set the example for what type of relationships we should have.
And do you think that the clip that we are discussing right now, and the syllabus of that we have in Malaysia, do you think this is an encapsulation of a wider problem we have in Malaysia? You touched on it a little bit earlier. That sex is often seen as taboo. Do you think that it's a wider problem we have in Malaysia, where oftentimes these things are rarely looked at it from a scientific or realistic approach? There's this cloud or prism where people look at it through the lens of culture and religion instead of the cold, hard scientific facts.
Yes, I think that one of the key issues, and we find this in all of the sexual and reproductive health and rights issues, right? So SRHR falls inside the health purview, and everything else in health, whether it's got to do with things like non-communicable diseases like diabetes or hypertension or cardiology or oncology, nobody looks at a religious or a cultural view for cardiology, right? However, because sexual and reproductive health has got to do with sex and reproduction, the moral, the religious, the cultural frames are brought to weigh in, in a way that other fields of health are not brought, right? So I think that's where people start saying, okay, now before I talk about the science scientific view, I'd like to address, the moral view around these issues. So whether it's about a variety of things, whether we've had these debates on HIV, due to this, we've had debates around, and intense debates, around access to safe abortion, which continues. In some communities, there are even like debates on permanent methods of contraception and how that's unacceptable. So the science element is not brought into, the focus as compared to the other lenses, right?
Right.
So, but definitely, I mean, my feeling is that, policies and programs around sexual and reproductive health, including sex education and comprehensive sexuality education and provision of contraceptives and services to young people who may not be married, need to be framed from that scientific evidence-based lens, primarily.
All right, we do need to go for a very quick break now. I'm speaking with Sivanandi Tanindran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women. And we are talking about the recent D-Date TV clip that went viral, in which a science teacher said a male and a female adult will need to get married before having a child. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and joining me via Skype right now is Sivanandi Tanindran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women. And we are talking about the recent D-Date TV clip that went viral, in which a science teacher said this, and I quote, "A male and a female adult will need to get married before having a child." And we are also talking about the importance of sex education, especially when it comes to kids, right, growing up. So, Siva, why is it still a taboo when it comes to talking about sex education or just sex in general with children? And how should parents and teachers go about discussing these kind of topics with them to make it less awkward?
Yeah, I think that, many people still have that apprehension, like we talked about, right, that if you start talking about sex, somehow it becomes acceptable, right, and maybe they will start engaging in sex at an earlier age, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's the big, wall that they don't want to, like, kind of breach, because they're worried what is going to come out. once that wall is breached.
Right.
So I feel like adults don't want to initiate those conversations. And then these are not easy conversations to initiate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as I explained before, like for myself even, right? My mom didn't initiate a conversation. She brought a book back. And, you know, when she was reading, when I was reading the book, I was like, oh my God, you know? I mean, like, okay, I think that my mom is telling me a lot of things by passing this book, which she doesn't want to say.
Right.
I think that, so it's definitely a difficult conversation to have. But the thing is, if we initiate a discussion and then, you know, it kind of reduces the stigma attached, kids will feel free to approach their elders or their parents when they're in doubt or in times of need. I mean, if they've done something and they're worried about it, you know, they can go to someone and seek the right help. Right. So that they can. So I think the open channel, not only for communication, but also for recourse, you know, in case something has happened, is there. You know, so I think that that's the key and the most important thing that exists when the conversation takes place. Comprehensive sexuality education is not about teaching teens how to have sex, but it informs them about the changes that are also taking place in their bodies and teaches them how to make those healthy and safe choices as they grow up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when teachers or parents provide that open channel, right, to address the conflicts and the doubts that pass through the minds of adolescent children and teenagers. Now, this is just not about, how do I say, sex alone, right? I mean, because you didn't only think about sex. You also thought about yourself, right? And how you were developing, you know, in those important teenage years. What was normal or what was not normal, you know? What's desirable and what's not desirable, right? For example, if as part of a hormonal change, you started sprouting hair all over the place, right, you know, for a guy. And then you think like, oh my God, you know, oh my God, is this normal? And, you know, should I live with it or should I, you know, shave a lot or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Because media may not show you the images of men with a lot of hair.
That's right. Yeah.
And the most important thing is, so you're navigating these feelings as well, right? And, you know, to care about somebody or to have a crush, to, you know, fall in love, these are all very normal experiences, right? Mm-hmm. So if parents normalize, oh, yeah, you know, when I was in school, oh, there was this boy and, you know, he was like, everybody liked this guy because he was like this, but I thought of him like that, you know. So if you normalize that kind of conversation, then, you know, children also think, okay, what I'm going through is something that's normal. I'm not alone in this. You know, I can share my feelings, whether they are feelings of high, which we also have, and the feelings of low, right? Because in those adolescent years, you really have these very swings of feelings that you may experience. So I think that, that's a very important thing, as I said, you know, to have that communication channel open.
But what are your thoughts on abstinence only, you know, people who argue for abstinence only education? Do you think, because that is something that a lot of people bring up, right, that if you do want to teach so-called sex education in school, why not just, instead of teaching about safe sex and the consequences of unprotected sex, why not just teach people abstinence only education, that it's only when you get married that's when you're allowed to have sex?
I think that it's not anything wrong with abstinence-only education. It's just that abstinence is one part of the story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So when you have comprehensive sexuality education, it doesn't say have sex. It also says you only have sex when you're ready to. And if you're not ready to have it, then you abstain. And then if you're in a relationship with someone else, then you need to find out whether they are ready to have sex and whether they are abstaining or not. And if they choose abstaining as a, how do I say, as what is their preference at that point, a moment in time in relationship, that you have to respect that choice that they make, that you don't either emotionally blackmail them, you don't trick them, you don't, you know, spike their drink and then rape them, you know. So that's, so for me, I feel like abstinence is one part of the story and everyone can choose to abstain at any point or moment in time that they choose to. But when they do choose to engage in sex, how do you do it? How do you protect yourself? And how do you stay safe? You know, is also the other part of the story or the other part of the information loop that, you know, young people need to know about.
Yeah. And also this idea of abstinence only, if, you know, people are looking at it as abstinence only education, it's not going to work. Right? Because even when we look at it right now, we live in a somewhat conservative, you know, Malaysia is not like this super liberal, super progressive kind of country, but yet you still have stories of teen pregnancies, you still have stories of baby dumping, you still have stories of consent being violated, you still have stories about teens having sex, all sorts of things, because it's something that, you know, depending on each individual, you're going to want to explore anyway, regardless whether you teach abstinence only or not. So it's better to help them, you know, get equipped with information so they can make informed choices, right?
I mean, like, there's a lot of, assumptions in this question that you had, right? Mm-hmm. So one is the assumption that, oh, we're a conservative society. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think what makes us a conservative society, I mean, all of these data that we've talked about previously, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, 50.4% of the students have had sexual intercourse before the age of 14. Right. But that doesn't sound like a super conservative society to me. So the conservatism is only coming in the context of, I think, discourse secting, but not necessarily reflective of human behavior. For example, when we talk about the Netherlands in contrast, right? So that would be a society we define as a super liberal society. The Netherlands is, of course, one of those countries along with other countries like Sweden and Finland and all who also, like, you know, have a very comprehensive, great comprehensive sexuality education from age 5. In the Netherlands, in contrast, students who receive the information actually abstain and their age of first sex is higher. You know, and I believe that the age of first sex, I remember when the Dutch ambassador was telling us this, was, I think, around 17 or 18. So the people were abstaining from sex for almost 3 years. I mean, they were deferring the age of first sex, you know, because comprehensive sexuality education also teaches you there are many ways that you can express love and feelings towards someone which are not related to sex. Whereas abstinence only kind of says, like, don't go there at all.
Right. And another thing, you know, I find very peculiar is how people as a society, you know, they are more okay with, you know, violence than sex. And, you know, if you're a kid, you're watching TV and there are action scenes where people are getting beaten up and it's bloody and people are shot, a lot of parents are okay with that. But the moment that, you know, an extensive making out scene, when there's an extensive making out scene or a nude scene, suddenly, you know, your parents tell you, you know, you have to close your eyes, you have to leave the room. There's a sense of awkwardness. You feel like you're watching something that you shouldn't, which usually just entices the kid even more to want to watch it. So if you're going by the theory that we don't want people to be influenced by what they see on screen, then shouldn't parents be more worried about the violence part than the sex part?
No, I mean, like, this is so absolutely true, right? And, you know, I mean, like, that just reminded me of all of those, you know, Tamil movies I used to watch with my grandmother and my mother, mm-hmm. right, when you were growing up. And you were right, you know, because, you know, you'd have these extensive fight scenes, you mm-hmm. know, and nobody says, cover your eyes, you know, and no one thought that because there were these fight scenes that somehow I was going to go and pick a fight with everybody.
Exactly.
Anything yeah. like that, right? I mean, like, nobody thought that. But somehow, like, when it comes to, like, you know, oh, if the hero and the heroine decide to, like, go close together for a kiss, then mm-hmm. they say, cover your eyes. And you think, like, that's just so strange. It's just a kiss, right? And we all knew what a kiss looked like or what was a kiss. But the thing is, we are not allowed to see that, you know? So this is, one of those things that if we actually saw people expressing love and affection all around us in so many different ways, then we ourselves would think that there's so many different ways of expressing love and affection, which may not be all sexual in nature, you know? Mm, yep. So I think you're absolutely right in like saying, like, why don't we sense more of the violence and why don't we have more of those expressions of love being shown to us as a society? And you're right, maybe we would turn up to be a kinder society.
Yeah, that one could hope, right? So do you think, Siva, it's important when we talk about education, when we talk about a science subject, right? Because I think it is, you know, it is perfectly fine for families to have their own values, for religion, you know, yada, yada, yada. But when it comes to education, do you think it's important we take a circular approach, we take an evidence database approach when it comes to, you know, dissemination of information to the public, especially on educational platforms, especially when it comes to kids?
No, definitely. I think, there is the need for us to take a scientific approach to these matters, you know, and as we've already discussed, right? I mean, the fact that 18,000 teenagers get pregnant every year, you know, and this is something like, what, 14 out of every 1,000. Ours is one of the higher rates. If you compare, I think in Singapore, it's 4 out of every 1,000. So, you know, it is a very large number of people who are trapped by lack of information. And these are decisions, I mean, like, these are, decisions that actually impact them for the rest of their lives, right? Mm-hmm. A teenage girl who has a pregnancy, and I believe that 25%, a quarter of them are out of wedlock. Yep. But the fact that this young person could have actually prevented that pregnancy if they had access to information and they had access to services, right? And the trajectory of their life would be so completely different. The access to educational opportunities and employment opportunities that this young person could have enjoyed is drastically different. I had my son when I was 30, and even then it was a tremendous responsibility. And we don't look at what are the kind of violations that happen in this young person's life because we did not give them the right information, which they could have used to protect themselves. There are many, many pieces of academic literature which have already been published, proving how comprehensive sexuality education allows young people to make the better choices for themselves. And if we don't take that path, then, you know, this is like, you know, the sad story of early marriages, early pregnancies, repeat pregnancies, higher mortality rates, and trajectory of life, which does not allow pathways to higher education and higher, better employment opportunities. That's definitely a huge gap in our society.
So then how do we get there? Because we are talking about the importance of comprehensive sexuality education. This is something we've talked about so many times, right? But how do we get there? How do we, you know, change the discourse from, you know, this that is sort of painting our country as this religious conservative country and so on and so forth, which, like you said, doesn't necessarily reflect the reality. How do we then change the discourse? How do we get to a point where there is, you know, substantial, proper, widespread discussion on the need and the necessity to have comprehensive sexuality education, and how do we make the masses embrace it?
Yeah, I think that there are a few things that need to be done. I think that one is, of course, all governments are kind of adopting that international guidance on comprehensive sexuality education that has been put out by UNESCO, and they're trying to bring it into their school curriculum. I do remember maybe a couple of years back when we had met with people in the Ministry of Education, that there was a lot of interest around the international technical guidance, I must say. I mean, as Aero, we've also organized something called the Regional Multi-Stakeholder Dialogue on Comprehensive Sexuality Education. We do this every once in 2 years, and we bring together different governments and different civil society. And that actually brought in this one that a lot of governments in the region are doing something, you know, with regards this syllabus, you know, and imparting CSE to their young people. And I think so that there's a regional standard that is being set. So we need to like kind of comply with that sort of regional standard, or our young people are going to get left behind. So that's one aspect of the piece, right? Mm-hmm. The second thing is, okay, when as government seems to be proving maybe a little slow on to make progress on this issue, that there is always a lot of resources that are being organized outside. There are a lot of internet resources that parents and communities can and schools can adopt for their school kids, right? So that, you know, just because government cannot fulfill the role right now doesn't mean that there needs to be a gap. And I think even like some part of it are like kind of tools developed by government agencies are also there. You know, for example, LPPKN has this initiative called Cafe at Teen, which kind of educates teenagers on sexuality education for free. So see, so this is not, let's say, in-school curriculum, right? But this is like something outside of it. So they open centers for teenagers and young people to go as a safe space to learn about relationships and reproductive health, right? They also talk about have sessions in this Cafe Teen, and they've also created an app called Cafe Teen, right? But there are still biases which emerge from that. That bias is like, you know, for example, you know, there's sexuality education, you know, for those who are sexually active versus those who are not. You know, and so this like there's this how do I say maybe a caste system, but unfortunately this creates more stigma in the long run, right? Because people will say, I don't want to go to that group, I want to be in this group, right? So so we have to like actually give accurate information and knowledge on sexuality education for all students or teenagers, regardless of, you know, their backgrounds. And I know that the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations of Malaysia, FRAM, also conducts outreach programs and talks and exhibitions, right? And there are also movements that are started by individuals and NGOs. So we have things like Hello Spot Girl, which is a movement focused on providing comprehensive sexuality education. And they have these programs to kind of educate, empower, and enable more women and girls by providing them relevant information, right, through age-appropriate and culturally sensitive approaches. So it's called SPOT. So they are designed in alignment to what I've spoken about, the International Technical Guidance of on Comprehensive Sexuality Education. We also have, I think, some young people have started this fantastic initiative called FYIKL, For Youth Initiative KL, which is a digital media initiative that aims to disseminate positive messages on sexual and reproductive health and rights in Kuala Lumpur. And it also, like, strives to provide a space for young people to in Malaysia to, like, share and express and discuss their thoughts on these taboo topics, you know. And I believe another youth-led initiative is like Let's Red Talks, you know, with the purpose of powering the youth to normalize, you know, periods and advanced sex education for all. So I think there are a lot of initiatives that are emerging because of this gap that is not there in the curriculum in schools for young people.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Siva.
Thank you, Dashrin, for having us.
All right. I've been speaking with Sivanandi Tanindran, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, also known as ARRO. And we were talking about the recent D-Date TV clip, or at least we were using that as a jumping off point, right, in which a science teacher said, and I quote, a male and a female adult will only get pregnant after they get married. And so what we were discussing is, you know, why that's a problematic way of teaching science and why Malaysia needs comprehensive sexuality education right now. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my. You can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to search BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.